This audio recording is under copyright protection, all rights reserved. Any duplication, transmission, or broadcast without permission is strictly prohibited by U.S. and international laws.
Well, thank you all for coming, and of course, thank you to everyone who is in all these 60-some different countries. I will be very excited to see the list, because it's always fascinating to see countries I forgot even existed. But this talk, of course, is Reaching the Reluctant Writer, so I would assume that you are here listening to this talk because you have, or possibly you are yourself, a reluctant writer. And I think that when we come to the teaching of writing, we find some challenges that make it perhaps one of the more difficult things to teach. And the first one of those is what I would consider aptitude differences. You know, if you have any group of children, two kids at home or 30 kids in a classroom, you always have an aptitude range. On one end of the spectrum would be kind of the 18-page kid. This child can whip out a spiral notebook and start a story and go on and on and on. And you read it and it goes on and on and on. And you're not quite sure how to help make it better, but whew, can they put words on paper? And you don't want to stifle that aptitude. But in the same group, you may have a child on the opposite end of the spectrum who would literally rather scrub all the floors in the building twice than have to put one entire paragraph on paper. It is so overwhelming. It is so painful. It is just a monstrous task, and you aren't quite sure how to help this child get through to having accomplished the thing you want them to accomplish without all sorts of problems. So I think we see this. Now, most kids are somewhere in between, but that aptitude difference can make it challenging to teach multiple children. The other thing that we discover is curricular options. Again, there's a spectrum, but not a whole lot in the middle. On one end of the spectrum would be what you might find, you know, the language arts workbook. It comes in the grade 3 flavor, the grade 4 flavor, the grade 5 flavor, and it tries to kind of do everything all at once in one kind of nice consumable book that you can work through and finish over the course of a school year and then get rid of. But it doesn't necessarily have the time or space or ability to teach much about how to do the writing. So it may provide prompts. Write a paragraph about your best friend. Be sure to include three details. Then, of course, the child may write something like, "My best friend is named Billy, and he is really cool and fun to play with. Period. I'm done." Well, that's not a paragraph. What's a paragraph? Longer, right? Well, I included three details. So you get in that kind of frustrating zone of having to do something but not necessarily knowing how to do that. On the other end of the spectrum would be those things you find in a teacher's supply store. You've seen these stores. You get in, you wade through racks and racks of stickers and posters and psychedelically colored pencils and little dinosaur erasers, and you finally find the books that was in the back. And you find the section on writing, and you pull one off, and it has all sorts of, you know, interesting prompt ideas, like write a blog post about the last time you went to a restaurant or something. And of course, the problem is this book is trying to help the child figure out something to write about, but again, not necessarily much help is given. And so what we find then is not much in the middle here. There's kind of the very traditional style of thing that tries to do everything, and then the creative writing idea book. So what we discover then is that what what sometimes works for one student in your family or your classroom doesn't necessarily work well for all of them. So what is the defining problem? When you're talking about a reluctant writer, if you say to a reluctant writer, why do you not like doing this? And once you get past the tautologies of because it's hard, because I don't know what to do, because I hate it, because it's horrible, and you get to some substantive idea, it very often is, I don't know what to write. How many of you have heard a child say this? I don't know what to write. I don't know what to say. I can't think of anything. Which shouldn't really surprise us because, well, for one, they're young children and they don't have that whole lifetime of decades of life experience and reading and talking and thinking. They have a relatively short period of time to draw from. Plus, children think differently than we do. Have you noticed this? Right? We can think about next month, next year, last month, last year, something on the other side of the globe, some abstract concept like inflation. Children are pretty much always thinking about one thing. What's that? Right now, yes. Tell me what to do, and I will do it so I can be done with it, so I can go make forts, which is the real business of life when you're 10 years old. And so we often get in this problem of spending so much time and energy trying to help them figure out what to write that nobody has time or energy left over to attend to how to do that well. So what we do and what I'm going to share with you today is a system that helps you kind of avoid this problem, at least initially, and get going in a way that I would say has 100% success rate. And that is to remove the problem. One of the things that we have come to understand very well is you don't have to figure out what to write in order to begin the process of learning how to write. Now, I want to back up just a little bit and think about writing. If someone wants you to write something, the first thing that must exist is an idea. You have to find the idea. If there is no idea, nothing can be written. Would you agree? Now, ideas can pre-exist in different ways. Ideas can pre-exist in the memory or the imagination, or they can pre-exist outside the mind in a more immediate fashion. So, for example, if I said, please write about the last trip you took with your family, I'm asking you to go find ideas that pre-exist in your memory and imagination. Whereas if I give you some information right here and now, then it's immediate. It comes into your senses and then into your mind, and that information is actually more readily available than if you have to go search around in your memory and look for ideas. You with me on this? Okay. The second thing is that idea can pre-exist in words primarily, or it can pre-exist not in words primarily. So an example would be, if I said, write about your dog, assuming you have a dog, right? I'm asking you to muster up information about your dog, and most of that information is not going to be attached to words yet. It's going to be visceral, emotional, right? What do? You play with a dog. You experience a dog. You pet a dog. The dog licks you. These are all things that for children are in that kind of ephemeral zone of emotional experience. And to talk about those things, you have to attach words to the ideas. This is a little bit hard, and this is why, if you ask many children, please write about your dog, they'll be, okay, great. And then they'll write, my dog is a really, really awesome dog. And I really, really love my dog because she is so awesome. And she's really, really a fun dog. And you would really, really love my super awesome fun dog. The end. What more is there to say, right? And so you hit that kind of point of frustration, like, well, you didn't really say anything, and there's nothing more. So how do you get past that? Also, ideas can pre-exist in words. So if I showed you or read you some information and it was immediate and it came into your senses through your ears and your eyes and it pre-existed in words, that would be a different type of information. You with me on this? So first thing we have to do is find an idea. It can pre-exist inside or outside the memory and imagination. It can pre-exist in words or not so much in words, but you gotta find it. Then whatever form it's in, you have to speak it into existence, right? Think about when you write something, you sit down to write something, first thing you do is you kind of talk to yourself, right? You ask yourself the question, what am I gonna write? And then you answer your question and you hear what you said to yourself and then you start putting that into words. Same thing for kids. So they have to have the idea, speak it into existence, hear what they heard themselves say to themselves. And you've probably noticed children can talk without necessarily hearing what they're saying, right? So they have to have that activity of listening. Then they have to hold in the memory that idea that they heard themselves say to themselves long enough to go and grab the first word and construct that word through whatever information is necessary, spelling, printing, mechanics that may be involved. Then they have to go to the memory, pull the next word, and then wrangle up the information to write that word, and then get the next word, and continue until that entire idea is now existing in a written form. Then go get the next idea in the sequence, speak it into existence, hear what they said themselves, say to themselves, hold it in the memory long enough to go get all the information and make this a continuous process. And when you think about it, it's insanely complicated. And yet we kind of just expect, okay, everyone should do this. I mean, it is a human function. But when you think about it, if there's a breakdown anywhere in the process, finding the idea, speaking it into words so that it exists in a concrete form, holding that in the memory and getting the information necessary to get the first one on paper or on a screen, you can imagine if there's a breakdown anywhere in that process, what does the child have to do? Start all over again and reconstruct from scratch. No wonder it can be frustrating. So what I'm going to show you today is a method of eliminating some of the biggest problems. Number one, what to write, by providing what we call a source text. So this is going to be a sequence of ideas that pre-exist outside the memory in words. This is the easiest place to start to help reluctant writers, really to help everyone, but especially reluctant writers. So we're going to give you a source text. You'll give your kids a source text. And this is so concrete, you could actually go home and do this tomorrow morning if you wanted to, although it's Sunday, so you probably wouldn't. Monday, perhaps, or in the fall when the school year starts. I don't know. But it's very, very, anybody can do this. All you need is a source text which is at or preferably below the reading level of the student. You would do best to err on below the reading level because we want this to be something that goes pretty fast, works pretty well, not a whole lot of struggle because we're talking about reluctant writers. So source text at or below. Also, we would like this source text, if possible, to be interesting or relevant to the child in some way. The more interesting or relevant, the more easily they will be able to reconstruct the memory of those ideas. I have found that most children are interested in things like unusual animals, especially if it's ugly or dangerous or disgusting in some way. That has a natural attraction to a lot of children, especially boys. But you're not limited. People, places. One of my favorite things to work with is Aesop fables, which is what we're going to use for our demonstration. Aesop fables have the advantage of being short. And when you're working with reluctant writers, short is good, right? They also have the advantage of being readily available and free. There's any number of places you can pull Aesop fables. You can edit them slightly if there's some antiquated vocabulary that might be not familiar enough. And there's almost an unlimited supply. I think AesopFables.com shows that there's over 170 or something, which I didn't know there was that many, but there are a lot. So you choose the source text at or below the reading level of the student. Then we're going to make what we call a key word outline by taking a maximum of 3 words from each sentence in this short little source text. This keyword outline will then assist in that whole process of recording the sequence of ideas in words so that it can be reconstructed most easily. The next step would be to kind of remove the original, look at the keyword outline, and then try to reconstruct verbally the content from the keyword outline. So this is that step of speaking the idea into existence again. So it came from words, it goes into abbreviated words, now it comes back into full sentences. And then the next step is to retell the content on paper, writing sentences from the outline. And then lastly, from the keyword outline. Once that process has been established, we can get into the techniques that can be taught to help the student improve the language that they are using and the product on the paper. So these are the first steps. Now, a lot of people, when they see this, they think, well, that seems too easy, or that's like cheating. If you're not thinking of all the content yourself, you're not really doing it. So you must not be really writing. You're not really learning. And this is not true, of course. But to the modern mind, sometimes this seems almost too easy or not fair. However, it is a very, very old idea. In fact, you can trace this idea to over 2,000 years ago, when they would train people in rhetoric. There's a thing called the progymnasmata, or progymnasmata, or however you want to pronounce your weird Greek words, where basically the first thing to train rhetoric would be retell a fable. And then various people throughout history have kind of found this, or rediscovered, or reinvented, if you will, this idea of imitation to improve writing. Probably the most notable example in a more modern age was Benjamin Franklin. I had a daughter in high school at one point, and she burst into my office one day. She said, Dad, have you read Benjamin Franklin's autobiography? And I said, well, yes, maybe, a long time ago. Don't ask me any difficult questions. And she said, no, Daddy, look, you've got to read this, because this is exactly how you taught me to write. And I read it, and I was much amazed with it, because it was almost exactly the system of making keyword outlines and reconstructing source texts to practice writing that I had learned years before and helped her in her childhood. So it's worth reading together. This is from the autobiography of Franklin. When my father happened to find my papers, he took occasion to talk to me about the manner of my writing, observed that although I had the advantage of my antagonist in correct spelling and pointing, which I owed to the printing house, I fell far short in elegance of expression, in method, and in perspicuity, of which he convinced me by several instances. I saw the justice of his remarks, and thence grew more attentive to the manner in writing, and determined to endeavor at improvement. Wouldn't it be great if all kids were like that? Our life would be so much easier. Moving on. About this time, I met with an odd volume of The Spectator. It was the third. I had never before seen any of them. I bought it, read it over and over, and was much delighted with it. I thought the writing excellent and wished, if possible, to imitate it. With that view, I took some of the papers and, making short hints of the sentiment in each sentence, laid them by a few days, and then, without looking at the book, tried to complete the papers again by expressing each hinted sentiment at length and as fully as it had been expressed before in any suitable words that should come to hand. Well, that's exactly what I just described in terms of have a source text, make a keyword outline, put the original away, and try to reconstruct from the keywords. Franklin somehow intuited that if he was going to improve his writing, he needed something to imitate. And this is really very true for anything we want to do in any kind of art. And art is something you have to do in order to learn it, right? You can't just memorize how to play the piano, you have to actually do it. So when you think about music or art or sports or dance or writing, really anything, if you just do what you can do, you will be able to do what you can do, but you will only be able to do what you can do because you're only doing what you can do. Do you follow that? But if there's a coach, a model, a higher example, something that you can emulate, then you're able to do more than you could have done because you are seeing what's possible outside the limitation of your own experience. Does that make sense? So if we want to improve, we need these coaches and models, and we look at imitation as the natural way in which pretty much all children learn everything. So we're working with this. So Franklin somehow intuited that that is what he needed to do. Moving on, we see, he says, "Then I compared my Spectator with the original, discovered some of my faults and corrected them. But I found I wanted a stock of words or a readiness in recollecting and using them, which I thought I should have acquired before that time. Since the continual occasion for words of the same import but of different length to suit the measure or of different sound for the rhyme would have laid me under a constant necessity of searching for variety and also have tended to fix that variety in my mind and make me master of it." Now, I think he wrote this before we had started to talk about the problem of a run-on sentence, because this is a little bit long and it has a lot of stuff in it, but if you slog through it a couple times, you get the point. What he was saying here is, as I tried to write these ideas, I realized I did not necessarily have the vocabulary or the grammar or the range of expression to do justice to the idea. Actually, what I think he's saying is, I sure could have used a thesaurus of the English language, which had not yet been invented at that time. Roget, who invented the thesaurus, came years later. And I think Franklin would very much approve of our methodology of giving children not just outlines of ideas to use, but lists of words and specific grammatical constructions to have to kind of wrestle with and wrangle and practice using as they are expressing those ideas. Now, moving on. This is really interesting. "I also sometimes jumbled my collections of hints into confusion, and after some weeks endeavored to reduce them into the best order before I began to form the full sentences and complete the paper." All right, that's super weird. Think about it. He took his notes, put the original away, then he intentionally mixed up all the notes so he could then reorganize them. Why would anyone do that? It is terribly impractical, right? Well, the next sentence answers it. "This was to teach me method in the arrangement of thoughts." Wow, what a great goal for us as parents and teachers, to help our students develop method in the arrangement of thought. But how is he doing this? Again, back on imitation. So he wasn't just trying to imitate the content and have something to write about. He was actually trying to imitate the logical sequence of ideas in the article or argument or whatever he was reading. In a way, he was training himself to do the type of thing we might have to do if we were doing some research with multiple sources, right? So if you have, you know, several different sources of information and you're extracting information, now you have to figure out what order to put that into. How do you fuse those ideas together in the best possible way? And so we actually have a unit where we teach that very explicitly. But Franklin was kind of into this, how can I play with this and improve myself? It's not in the selection I chose, but he also mentions how he would take a poem and write it into prose, and then he would take prose and try to write it into poetry, so that he would kind of do this cross-genre idea of wrestling and manipulating and learning and mastering various words and grammatical usages and things. All right, now from here it gets very, very significant for reluctant writers, right? For teaching reluctant writers, because this is the key to motivation right here. By comparing my work afterward with the original, I discovered many faults and amended them, but I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that in certain particulars of small import, I had been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me to think I might possibly in time come to be a tolerable English writer, of which I was extremely ambitious. Now, that's very important because it shows what motivated him. Read it again because it's very interesting. I sometimes had the pleasure of fancying that in certain particulars of small import, I have been lucky enough to improve the method or the language, and this encouraged me. It's that certain particulars of small import, and I find this to be absolutely true, 100% of the time. I spent many, many years traveling a lot, and I would go mostly teaching demonstration classes in schools, or mostly homeschool kids, I would say. And sometimes I felt these kids were coming in at knife point, right? You know, they're coming in the door, they got the raccoon eyes, you know they've been crying in the car, mom's behind them, you're going in there. And this idea of a 2-hour writing class is as close to real purgatory as they have got so far in their life. And those same kids will leave 2 hours later saying stuff like, that was fun. Can I do that again? Is he coming back? Why? My great jokes? I don't think so. They had this experience. They might have walked out of that classroom with a version of the hare and the tortoise that was almost word for word the same as the one that I gave them to start with, except for one or two little things. Maybe they put in a cool ly adverb that they thought was fun, and so they added that. Or maybe they got the idea, well, let's change the judge from an owl to a cheetah, and that way nobody will get caught cheating. But they, you know, these little things. And why is this so powerful? Well, I would argue that it's powerful because this is what life is about. I mean, for most of us, we will go to our deathbed having gained satisfaction out of life by making our little corner of the world better in some small way. Very few of us are going to become a great creative genius. Very few of us are going to be a Nikola Tesla or a Florence Nightingale or a C.S. Lewis, right? But what I find particularly a beautiful irony is that Franklin, who articulated this method that he was practicing through imitation, did become a great creative genius. And when you set it up to either, you know, say or imply, or children get this idea that somehow, you know, they have to be unique, be original, be creative, do something that nobody ever did before, this can be a tremendous burden on a child. It's almost saying, kid, be like God, right? I mean, well, God produces something from nothing. The rest of us are kind of stuck with what we've got, right? So when we have something to work with, and then we have lists and systems and methods of doing things, creativity is much more possible. One comparison people have made is clay versus Legos, right? So here's a blob of clay, make something nice. Well, that's really hard to do when you're a little kid. It's really hard for me. I hate clay, right? But Legos, yes, okay, there's pieces and there's plans. We can do this, you see? And then what's very likely is a child who plays with Legos a lot is going to do much better when you give them clay. But even then, they'll need guidelines and instruction. They'll need something to imitate and modeling, which is ironic if we're talking about clay. All right, so Franklin, I've read this thousands of times, and it's interesting. Every time I read this, I kind of get a little more insight into the truth of this. But we want to jump in and try this because I want you to be able to go home and do this tomorrow. So, you didn't hand it out. Okay. That's okay. I thought it was going to be in that cute little book that you made for everyone.
We had that great thought this morning.
Yeah, well. You could just read it right there, but. Okay, so we're handing out a piece of paper that has this particular story in it. And so you can, if you're at home and you haven't printed it, you're welcome to. I think you'll also be able to read it on the screen. We're going to actually make a keyword outline, so I do hope that you've got something to write on. One reason I like Aesop fables is because you can use them with anyone. You can use Aesop fables with 8-year-olds, and you can use Aesop fables with high school or college students. Nobody complains about Aesop fables. And so in that way, they're very handy. I also like them for the first kind of lesson because they have a little narrative line. The story may already be familiar to the students, but if not, it's something they can, you know, kind of get a hold of and put in their brain pretty easily. So the first step is we take the source text and just read it. And I have chosen this particular source text because I believe that it is at, or most likely below, your reading level. But you would adjust in your mind for the students you're teaching, you know, what would you want? Keeping in mind it's always better to err on the side of it being a little shorter, a little simpler, a little lower kind of reading level. The Fox and the Goat. By an unlucky chance, a fox fell into a deep well from which there was no escape. A goat passed by and asked the fox, "What are you doing down there?" "Oh, have you not heard?" said the fox. "There's going to be a great drought, so I came down here in order to be sure to have water by me." "Why don't you come down too?" The goat thought this a good idea and jumped down into the well. But the fox immediately sprang onto the goat's back and by putting a foot on the goat's long horns, managed to hop up to the edge of the well. "Goodbye, friend," said the fox. "Remember, be careful of the advice of one who is in trouble." Okay, maybe you've heard this story before. It kind of is the story of modern business, right? I mean, quick, buy this stock for me because I know what's gonna happen. I need to escape, you know, so you get that. But, and the other thing, of course, is Aesop picked on foxes a lot. And I used to feel it somewhat unfair that the fox would always get the, you know, the criminal element assigned to it. But then we had chickens, and the fox it would just come in and just kill chickens. It didn't even eat them. It would just bite their heads and kill them for no apparent reasons. So I am now of the opinion that foxes basically are criminal, and they deserve the bad reputation that Aesop gave them. But nevertheless. Okay, so there's our source text. And with students, I would read it through. I might double check if there's any words that are less familiar. Drought might be one. I've got to be sure they would understand all that. So I'd read it through, talk about it a little bit. And then we move to the next step of making a keyword outline here. And so it's a very simple process. We go back and read the first sentence again, stop, and then choose a maximum of 3 key words from that sentence. So we have, by an unlucky chance, a fox fell into a deep well from which there was no escape. All right, now I would ask students, what would you consider to be key words in that sentence, words that would help you unlock or remember the basic idea of the sentence. Just shout something out. What might you go for?
Fox.
Fox. And I would say, well, yes, fox, it's the subject of the sentence, but we actually have it already in the title, and I would have had them write the fox and the goat on the piece of paper there. And so I might say something like, well, we already wrote fox. We're not likely to forget it's about a fox, so we could use some other words. What else might be useful?
Fell.
Fell.
Well.
Escape, but no escape, right? So we could use that little symbol, like no, right? No smoking, no guns, no escape. So kids kind of like that idea of, oh, we can put some symbols with our words, and that's very helpful. So what I would recommend with young children or reluctant writers, or you're mildly dyslexic or really dyslexic, anybody in that zone, is that you allow them a piece of paper wherein they can underline the keywords that they choose. So underline first, then copy into the keyword outline. Now, I honestly don't like PowerPoint all that much because it's hard to do anything different than what you pre-planned. I actually love those overhead projectors. Do you remember those? With a piece of plastic and you could just write down what people say and it would appear. And now you need, technology, $1,000 and a lot of expertise to write down something that someone says. So I had to kind of, in making this, guess what you might choose. But I say this because there is no right answer to keyword outlines. And this is very important. There are many ways to choose three words that will help you reconstruct the idea. So don't assume that just because what I put in the PowerPoint is the only right answer in terms of which keywords would you choose. But you might have chosen fell, well, and escape, and there we have the little knot through the escape. So hopefully that reminds us later on that a fox fell into a well and could not escape. Okay, so we go to the next sentence. A goat passed by and asked the fox, "What are you doing down there?" All right, keywords, what do you like? Shout out.
Goat.
We could go with goat. We've got it in the title, but we might forget who's doing what. So I always point out to the kids, if you've got a main character, a main thing that you're going to use again and again, or a couple of them, you could use the initial, and then that would just remind you. So I might just say, let's put G, and then in our system, symbols, numbers, and abbreviations, up to a certain limit, are free. So you can have the G plus three other words. All right, so what do you like in addition to that? Passed, asked, what with a question mark. That might work, or another option, doing with a question mark. Either one of those would be just as good. Okay, so you would underline and then transfer those into the keyword outline. You'll notice that we are separating our keywords with commas. And this discipline of using commas between the keywords is extremely helpful. And if we establish this here in the very beginning, as we move toward getting information from in different ways. So let's say we're retelling longer stories, so we can't use every single sentence, or we're doing report or research where we have to summarize, or we're in inventive writing, taking notes from our memory or imagination. Having the habit of commas in between keywords is very, very helpful, because then you limit to three and your mind will kind of fill in the things that are missing between the keywords there. So we're pretty strict about that. All right, next sentence. Have you not heard, said the fox, there's going to be a great drought. So I came down here in order to have water by me. All right, now that's a little bit longer of a sentence, but you still only get three. What do you like?
Heard.
Not heard, could do that. Drought, that's probably a good one. I would always tell the kids, look, if you don't know how to spell a word, be sure you pick that one. Because if you copy it from the source text in the outline, then when you're writing it, if you need to figure out how to spell it, you don't have to. It's right there. So drought would be in that category. And you could have one more.
Water.
Water, okay. So those might be your key words. There are, of course, other options. And underline, and then you can transfer them in. You'll notice that there's an F to remind you, okay, the fox now was talking, and there's quotation marks to remind you that this is a conversation, question mark. So all the punctuation can also be helpful in terms of symbolic enhancement of the keywords. All right, going to the next sentence then. It's a short one. Oh, sorry. Why don't you come down too? Well, now this is hardly fair. The other one was so long and this one's so short. Couldn't we say borrow one from a short one and apply it to? No, it doesn't really matter. And here's the interesting thing. It doesn't actually matter what your limit is as long as you have a limit. So when I'm teaching up through middle school about, I will limit to 3 words. High school, sometimes I'll just go with 4 per sentence because the source texts are likely to be a little more sophisticated, having sentences that are a little bit longer. But it really doesn't even matter. What matters is that you have a limit and you stick to it. Because if you're too nice, right, and the student says, well, this is a longer sentence, couldn't I have another word? Sure. Well, now you've got, well, if she could have 4, I'm sure I could have 5. Well, 5, 6, what's the difference? 6, 7, pretty soon what's happening? Yeah, you'd be writing whole sentences or whole chunks of them. The essence of the key word activity would have been lost. So that's why we're very strict. Regardless of the length of the sentence, 3 words. Now this is our beginning steps, and later on we will change the rules to make it a little easier for children to be more accurate. But in the beginning, starting with a strict limit, it's the best way to go. Okay, so we have, what was it? Have you not heard? Or no, what was it? Why don't you come down too? Okay, what do you like for that one? Come down too. You too. In fact, there's no rule that says you have to have 3 words. So if you feel like you only need 2 or 1, you can do that. So maybe you end up with just you too. And hopefully you remember it was the fox talking. And again, the fables have that narrative line. They exist in the child's imagination pretty immediately after reading it and hearing it. So, okay, we come to the next one. The goat thought this a good idea and jumped down into the well. This is the point where some student in the group will say, that is a really stupid goat. True, but it's an Aesop fable. So, what do you like? Good idea. Jump. Okay, sure, that might work. Or you come up with something like, gee, thought idea down. Right, doesn't really matter. You can, I have found that there are so many different possible combinations of keywords that whatever kids say, I'll usually go with. Although, I have met students who dislike the act of putting letters on paper so intensely that they will choose the shortest words in every sentence, and then they get into and the, and that's a hard one. Usually, that solves itself when they realize those aren't going to be helpful in reconstructing the ideas later on. So, all right, coming into the next to last sentence here. But the fox immediately sprang onto the goat's back and by putting a foot on the goat's long horns, managed to hop up to the edge of the well. All right, so what do you like there? That's a little bit of a long sentence, so you kind of have to think it through. First thing that happened, sprang on the back, and then onto the horns, and then up to the edge or out. Yep. At which point, some student in your group is likely to say, hold on a minute. The first sentence said this was a deep well. This is not a deep well. If it's only 1 goat height tall, it's all relative. But, you know, my response would be, It's a story. It's a fable. You just suspend reality the way you do when you go to see superhero movies, right? You don't believe all that either. So, all right. So maybe you come up with something like F, Backhorn's Edge, and then you've got the last sentence here. And very often in a first lesson, when I'm doing this with students, I'll do all of it together with them, kind of like I'm doing it with you. And then I'll get to the last one and say, okay, I think you've got the hang of it. Try this one yourself. So you try this one yourself. The last sentence there. Goodbye, friends, said the fox. Remember, be careful of the advice of one who's in trouble. So go ahead now and you choose the three words you like. You can underline them if that helps you at all. And then transfer them into the last line of the keyword outline on your handout there. We'll see what you get. What did you put down?
Goodbye, well, F, goodbye, advice, trouble.
Goodbye, advice, trouble, excellent. Did anyone else get those exact three same words? Okay, that's wonderful. Anyone get something slightly different? What'd you go with?
Remember.
Advice trouble, that'll work too. Anyone get something slightly different than that? Yes?
Careful advice trouble.
Careful advice trouble, that'll work too. Anything different? Yeah?
I did buy careful ear sign to like to listen.
Okay.
Or like take the advice and then trouble.
Okay, so you incorporated a little ear.
Yes.
For the listen.
Yes.
Yeah, you almost need the not sign over the ear. Don't listen to the advice, yeah. It gets then you might not recognize the ear. So the thing about symbols is they have to be kind of easily recognizable by the student at a later time, but they can be very helpful. So lots of options there in this last sentence. Good. Okay, so that's kind of the process of creating the keyword outline. Now we move to the next step. Does anyone remember what the next step was? Tell it back verbally, yes. So we go now to the outline, we kind of have removed the original, and we just look at the keyword outline and say, okay, we wrote fell, well, escape with the not sign. Why did we write that? What was the idea connected with those keywords? And then with a small group of children, I would say, okay, could anyone volunteer? Could anyone make a sentence out of those keywords that kind of approximates the original? You want to give it a shot?
Sure. A fox fell into a deep well and could not escape.
Okay. A fox fell into a deep well and could not escape. Now, was hers exactly like the original? No. Do I care? No. Did she say it in a complete sentence? Yes. Do I care?
Yes.
We want complete sentences. And occasionally, I may meet a child who doesn't get that idea. They don't speak in a complete sentence. I would say almost all children, by the time they're old enough to read and do this at all, 7, 8 years old, whatever, they naturally speak in complete sentences. And so it's very rare that I meet a child who can't kind of just get this idea quickly. But if there's maybe a learning challenge of some sort, or more likely a second language, English as a second or foreign language, in that case, if the child can't articulate the sentence, I will simply say a sentence and make them repeat it back. And say it and repeat back, say it and repeat back. And I'll just model it very, very tightly. And I would say almost always within 3, 4, 5 times that child will get the hang of this idea. So it's not terribly difficult or complex. All right, good. Now we come to the next one. G, past, ask, doing. Could anyone give us a sentence that would approximate the original there? You want to give it a shot?
Sure.
Okay.
The goat passed by and asked, what are you doing?
All right, the goat passed by and asked, what are you doing? Perfect. Okay, next one. F, herd, drought, water. Yes, sir. Yes. All right. So far, so good. All right. Next one. That's a short one. If you want a short one, grab this one.
Why don't you come down too?
Why don't you come down too? All right. Next one, G thought idea down. Who'd like to try that? Sure. Okay, we did that one just now, so we're on the next one, number five there.
That's a great idea, thought the goat who came down.
Okay, that's a great idea, thought the goat who came down. Good. It didn't happen, but it was close, and sometimes it does happen that a student would look at the keywords and just be blank, right? Like, I cannot remember why I wrote those words. No idea comes to me connected with that. At that point, is it okay for the student to go back, read the original again, refresh their memory, and then continue on in the process? Absolutely. This is not a test of the child. That is a really important concept. This is not a test of the student. It's the student testing the outline to be sure that it works. And if it doesn't work, well, then fix it. So if you're stuck, you look at the three keywords, you don't remember why you wrote those, go read it again. You may say, oh, you know what, this other word would help me a lot more. Cross out the one you don't want and replace it with one that you do want. So there is flexibility. And again, it's not, you don't want the students to ever feel like this is a test of them or their memory or any of that. And some kids kind of will default, oh no, I'm not doing it exactly the right way, or oh no, I forgot something, I'm bad or wrong. No, it's just refresh yourself, continue on. All right, coming to the next to last sentence, F, back, horns, edge. Someone try that one for us. The fox jumped onto the goat's back, onto the horns, and up to the edge of the well. Perfect. Good. All right. There you go. Now, the last one, you're going to have to look at your own paper. And this is what I would do with kids, is say, okay, look at your own paper and the keywords you chose and try to make a sentence out of those. You want to do it for us? All right, the fox said, see you later, but be careful never to take the advice of someone in trouble. And then, of course, some Aesop fables always kind of explicitly work in that moral, or maybe they'll have a last sentence tacked on there, and the moral is, and then others end a little more abruptly, and it kind of depends on which versions you have as to whether they tack on that moral statement or not. I have heard people claim the old versions of Aesop fables never did have, and the moral is, you would just get to think about it for a while. But I guess humans have become less able to think over time, and so now we have to add in, this is what you should think out of that story. But it's interesting, I like the stories that don't necessarily have that moral, because sometimes you ask the kids what do you think this means? What do you learn from this? They'll come up with crazy ideas that were not part of your repertoire of what morals of Aesop fables should be. But okay, so there we have then the keyword outline. We've talked it back. And with children, I might even do that twice, right? In a classroom, I might talk it through with the first seven volunteers and then talk it through with the next seven so that everybody who can or who wants to will get a chance to participate. Another thing you could do is you can take kids and pair them up and say, okay, here, you use your keyword outline, tell the story to him. Okay, now you use your keyword outline, you tell the story to her. And you can go back and forth. So that's another way that you can practice this telling it back. And then sometimes I'll say, you know, for homework, go find someone to tell this to. Using your keyword outline, your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister, and if nobody's available, you can tell it to your cat. It doesn't really matter who's listening, but you get that active reconstructing verbally the sentences. And then you're more well prepared for the next step, which is to write it out. So, you know, talk through the keyword outline, speaking in complete sentences, You can do it a few times. Then you move into writing. Now, there are a few things I think is very important to keep in mind when you are asking children to write on paper. Okay? The first and most important thing to keep in mind is that English composition, spelling, and handwriting are very, very different brain functions. They're so different that they don't even start to have information stored in the same parts of the brain, right? Composition is a language function. It's when you are putting words into sentences that make sense and putting sentences into a logical order. That's a language function, and it's much more similar to speaking than anything else. But spelling is not in that same way a language function. In fact, spelling is super weird, isn't it? When you think about it, spelling is probably the weirdest thing that English-speaking people ever have to learn. And there's a whole lot of languages that make a whole lot more sense because English is both rich and confusing because we've got all these different linguistic systems fighting all the time. So Greek and Latin and a little bit of German and some weird French and some Anglo-Saxon, who knows what else is all mushed in. So one of the things that I point out is that you don't want a child to feel as though they have to spell everything correctly and make beautiful letters. Because if you ask them to do all three of those things, composition, spelling, and handwriting, as good as they can, you may split their brain and they do none of it well. I think the best analogy I can come up with is driving. Have any of you had the great pleasure of teaching a teenager to drive a car? I've done this 7 times. And it's very interesting because when you first get in a car with this 15-year-old, they are using every erg of energy to concentrate, right? There's this pedal and this wheel and these mirrors and these other cars, and I can do this and not kill us. And you are very grateful that they are using every erg of concentration to not kill you. After you've been driving 10 years, what happens? You get in a car, you start driving. And you can do all sorts of other things. Find your audiobook, let's surf the radio, drink your Starbucks. My wife can put makeup on while she's actually driving a car. Eat. You can think of all the things you can do while you're driving and not even notice that you're driving a car, right? And why is that? Because you've been doing it long enough that those separate functions have now become sublimated or automatic, right? Same thing happens with composition, spelling, and handwriting, but that can take time. And different children take different amounts of time. So if what you want is good English composition, don't at the same time pester them about spelling everything right and getting it neat. So a few strategies that I use to help with this is no erasing allowed. This is somewhat counterintuitive, but I guarantee you this is an absolute better way to operate. Now, to do it, you must enforce double spacing. So they're going to write on one line and skip the next line. However wide their lines are, it doesn't really matter. But they're going to skip every other line. So that's very important. And then, if you can't erase, you just have to line out what you don't want and keep going. Or if you want to change something you already wrote, you line it out and you write something above and keep going. And so this frees the student from that burden of this thing has to look good, right? And I always say, I don't care what it looks like. What I care is how does it sound when I read it? And so that's free. And some children are more attached to that kind of perfectionism, and you want to get rid of that. That type of perfectionism is actually the enemy of good writing because in the end, good writing is about being willing to change stuff and change it maybe again and again and again until you've got just the right word or combination of words for the purpose. I would even go so far as to say, if you want a hugely improved experience, have them write in pen, not pencil. There are a few reasons for this. Number one is a pen, unless you have one of those really heretical devices, the erasable pen, which should not exist, If you write with a pen, you can't erase it, so the temptation is gone, right? So it's easier to just line it out and keep going, line it out right in the space above. However, there are more reasons as to why pen is better for children. One is you've probably noticed that children have a compelling need to sharpen their pencils, right? And the reason for this is that pencils are tactilely, emotionally, and physically unnerving to children. And the reason is because when you start writing with a pencil, it gives you one level of friction, but 2 minutes later, it's duller. So it's giving you a different tactile kinesthetic experience, which is a different level of friction. 2 minutes, it's duller, and it's changed again. And 2 minutes after that, it's so different from what you started from. There's a compelling need for consistency. That's why children want to sharpen their pencils all the time. You think it's because they want to get up and walk around a little bit. No, give them a pen, they'll stay there for an hour sometimes. So that's another thing. A third reason, it would be for, you know, a lot of reluctant writers may have what you could possibly call a mild dyslexic tendency or something. I wouldn't call it that. I would just call it not cooked yet, right? They're just visually immature. It's going to sort itself out. But when you have a visual immaturity, what children want is a darker line because it's easier to see. And I've talked to any number of parents who have confirmed the fact that their mildly dyslexic son wants not only a dark line, but will write over the same letter two or three times to make it as dark as possible. You don't have to do that. Well, why do they do it? Because they like to see the darker lines. It's easier for them to process the information. Again, pencils are not black. They're not dark. They are gray. And in order to make it darker, you tend to push harder, which can cause tired hand disease. Mm-hmm. Any of you have kids that claim tired hand disease? They write three words and then they're exhausted, have to fall on the floor and get back up on the chair and then explain why they can't possibly write another word because they're, well, it's just stamina, it's just musculature. But they're pushing very hard often. And also, if you push hard enough, you will break the tip of your pencil and now you have to go sharpen it again. So if you're totally married to pencils, then the best thing for most reluctant writers would be soft lead, thick lead, mechanical pencils, which are consistent and soft and give a darker line without more pressure. But then you've got to deal with the clicking and the lead falling out all over the place and everything. I'm just saying, scrap the pencil, send it to math where it belongs, use a pen, and your life will be better. In fact, that whole thing, I don't know, some of you are old enough to remember in school, they'd say rough draft in pencil, final in pen. Should be exactly the opposite. Rough draft in pen, so you don't waste any time. Final in pencil, so if you make a transcription error, you can fix it, right? Now, these days, a lot of people are asking the question, well, what about typing? And there are many arguments against even the value of teaching handwriting in our modern world. I'm not going to engage that. But what I will say is that I think it's perfectly okay to have, say, a rough draft in pen, and then if you type the second one, then you can get more editing, and you can fix that and get a third and more perfected version of the thing without a whole lot more work. Whereas to re-handwrite something a third time, you just wouldn't do it. Nobody would do it. It's not worth it, right? However, I would try to keep that student on paper for that first draft as long as possible. You'll start to lose the battle around 13, right? So 12, 13, 14, that should be, why do I have to write on paper? How come I can't type it? Everybody types everything. You're just mean. Okay, fine. But if you let them start typing everything at 7 and they never do much writing on paper, then you could end up with a child who is an adult and can't actually write much on paper at all. I think all of us appreciate the ability to write on paper. So if you kind of keep going with that and then take the advantage of technology. The exception would be the child who's just so dysgraphic they can't possibly do it, in which case you would let them type, understanding that technology will atrophy the skill which it replaces, right? So, All right, so that's the idea of pen. The third thing is that you can then start introducing stylistic techniques, right? Now, we have a lot of these things, and I'm only going to show you four of them here that we have. The first one that I use pretty much in every class I ever teach is the LY adverb. I start with this because it is the easiest part of speech to use in a sentence. It's very flexible. It can move and exist in different places in the sentence and still be grammatically correct. Children are motion-based creatures, so they relate to the amplification of motion through adverbs more easily than they do other less concrete, a little bit more abstract grammatical ideas. And then we move into other things. So you see the four of our dress-ups here, LY adverb, who, which, clause, strong verb, and quality adjective. The most important thing, though, is that you don't dump all these on your student in the first assignment. Oh, you made your first keyword outline. Now you have to do all four of these dress-ups in this first composition. No. Our idea is easy plus one. So you start with one technique, and you give them lots of support so that they can do it successfully, and then they do it again and again until it becomes easy, which in my definition means student can do it without much help, and it doesn't sound too goofy most of the time. And then you can add in the next technique. But you don't want to just say, here, do it. You want to show and do it together so they get the idea of how this works. So here is a way that I might do this. Okay, that's missing an animation there. But so we have the keyword outline. Okay, that I would say, everybody look at your keyword outline. Now, the first thing that happened, the fox fell in the well. How did the fox fall? Now, just imagine I have a whiteboard and I'm writing down all the words you're saying. How did he fall in the well? He fell dramatically. Quickly. He fell suddenly. He fell unexpectedly. He fell
awkwardly.
Foolishly. Okay, let's go to the next thing. He saw the goat pass by and ask, what are you doing? How did the goat ask? The goat said,
curiously
asked, what are you doing? Say again?
Naively
asked.
Sarcastically
asked. Okay, there's a good one. Say again? Tentatively asked. Okay. Now the fox said, oh, there's going to be a drought. You better get down here. How did the fox say that?
Slyly.
Say again? Slyly. Yeah, always the foxes do slyly. What else?
Dryly.
Convincingly.
Cunningly.
Dryly. Love the irony there. Okay, so I might spend time going through the whole outline and coming up with maybe a couple dozen LY adverbs that are kind of guaranteed to work in that story. So now there's a list that's available to the students, either on the wall in a classroom or a homeschool classroom, or maybe in a notebook. They've copied that list. Then when they go to write the story, there's a little checklist, and the checklist says somewhere you have to have at least one LY adverb in this when you write it up. And if you flip your paper over, you'll see kind of a little example of a checklist down at the bottom. And so, again, the first assignment for most kids, you just have one thing on the checklist. When that becomes easy, then you would add in a second thing and do those two things in each little assignment or paragraph. When that becomes easy, you could add in a third one, and over a period of weeks, months, or years, you would have a number of stylistic techniques that the child is practicing kind of in a cumulatively growing list so that eventually doing lots of things in each paragraph of each assignment should be relatively easy, right? So that's the key, is don't do too much too fast. So you're going to then Just to review, you're going to find a source text which is at or below reading level of the student. Hopefully that source text is interesting to some degree. You will teach them how to make the keyword outline by reading each sentence again and choosing three, underline and copy if you like. Then tell back verbally the content. And then when you ask them to write it, try to separate the complexity by having the no erasing rule. And then you can add in the dress-ups as they become easy. Another talk, which I will be doing this afternoon, is the four deadly errors of teaching writing. And I think that that would be very, very helpful for anyone who is embarking on this approach of teaching writing through imitation. So with that, you end up, hopefully, with an improved attitude and good results. It's important to understand that, you know, we at the Institute for Excellence in Writing do a whole lot more than this. And sometimes people will try this idea of taking keywords from every sentence and think that's the whole program. No, but this is pretty much guaranteed to move a writer from absolute hatred and reluctance to a little bit less hatred and reluctance. I have no guarantees on happiness. But then, of course, I tell kids, you don't have to like writing. Nobody says you have to like it. I don't like it. I'd rather not do it. But if you can do it well, then you have advantages. And so, moving forward, we have some free lessons available. If you go to our website, iew.com/free-lessons, or iewschools.com/free-lessons, you can get some lessons like this one, only video of me teaching kids, also our Fix-It grammar, which we'll also be talking about later today, the whole idea of what about grammar. So that's about all we have for you in this session, and I hope that was helpful. If you have any questions, ask me at the break, ask any of our team. If you're online and you have some questions, we've got, I think, a number of people ready and happy to answer any questions you might have in the text or chat functions of however you're watching it. So thank you all very, very much.
Thanks for listening. Do you have questions or comments? Please contact the Institute for Excellence in Writing at 1-800-856-5815 or visit our website, iew.com.